I'm Linda van Tilburg for BizNews. Well, Pravin Gordhan, who passed away this week, was a respected ANC cabinet minister, renowned for his battle against state capture and his two terms as finance minister. Tributes have flooded in, highlighting his pivotal role in strengthening the South African Revenue Service, or SARS, against state capture, with whistleblower Johan van Lochrenberg dubbing him a superhero. In the heady days of the 90s, after Nelson Mandela's release from prison, and in the midst of negotiating a new constitution at Kempton Park, Gordhan was entrusted to lead the Convention for a Democratic South Africa, or CODESA, and the Transitional Executive Council, or the TEC, that set the stage for the country's first democratic elections in 1994. Well, working closely with Gordhan at that time was Dr. Teens Yalof, who was the head of administration of the multi-party negotiation process. And he's here in the business studio with me. Hi, Teens. So nice to speak to you again.
Nice speaking again.
So, Teens, what can you tell us about the man you worked with so closely during the Kempton Park years?
Yeah, Pravin was an unassuming person on the face of it. You know, he was a trained dentist. I don't know whether he ever practiced dentistry. I met him at the CODESA, the first round of negotiations, and he was formerly a member of the Natal Indian Congress, but obviously I think also a member of the ANC. And perhaps he, as one looks at his later positions when he was Minister of State Enterprises, probably also a member of the SACB, but I never knew that. I got to know him. I think the most important role that he played. He was part of a 10-person planning committee, consisting of a number of parties across the spectrum, who acted as a sort of an executive, but without executive powers, to filter all the proposals that came from the technical negotiating committees. It would come to the planning committee first. If we thought there were issues there, then it would be referred back. And that planning committee rotated chairs, so there wasn't one chair only. And the same happened with the negotiating council. One of the problems in the first CODESA was that people felt that some of the chairs were not impartial. So what we did with the multi-party negotiating process is to ask parties to nominate people who they thought would be good and impartial chairs. And that people like Pravin, David de Villiers, a number of others were, for all parties, were then a rotating panel, and he was one of those chairs, and he did extremely well. He was a very good chair. So as a member of the planning committee, we worked closely together, and some of the viewers would remember that there were two people who really informally but very real oiled the wheels of the process, namely Mac Maharaj and Fanny van der Merwe. And one can say that Pravin was almost a third member of that little committee. If there seemed to be a problem somewhere, a deadlock or a thing, he would often join Mac and Fanny. But in the planning committee, he was really looking for a way forward, for compromises. And even at that time, one felt his integrity. You know, you could trust him. I know that we differed ideologically. Obviously, my ideology wasn't important. I was the administrator, but one knew that he was left leaning and he was probably a socialist. But in that process, I felt that, and others felt that we could trust him to make the best and make the process as work. And you would remember that many people wanted to let the process fail, not only inside the negotiations but also outside. So I can really say that the man that I got to know was a principled negotiator, but he was also a facilitator. He was also trying he understood compromise. He understood that both sides, or more often it was more than one side, had to make compromises to get us to the best best solution. So I would say that together with, obviously in the background, Mandela and de Klerk, and then more in the foreground, Cyril Ramaphosa and Rolf Meyer, he together with Fanny van der Merwe and Mac Maharaj, I would single out as the three people who behind the scenes, not in the public limelight, really made the process work.
So, you know, I covered the negotiations for the SABC, and I see you've got a picture of the at the World Trade Center, which was a former factory that they overnight turned into this center where it all took place. And I think we spent 5 years or something there. Well, we spent quite a lot. No, well, all the way up to the elections, we spent there. And I always remember him as, you know, a very calm presence. And to the media, us, I was a SABC TV journalist at the time, he was always very accommodating. In your personal relations working with him, did you find that?
Yes, absolutely. He was sympathetic. He was understanding. One felt that you could go to him as a member of the planning committee and say, we've got a problem here. And he wouldn't act like a member of the Natal Indian Congress or the ANC. So that was the type of role he played. And I think he really meant it. He really, he was very honest. His integrity showed. So one felt that one could trust him. One of my colleagues, Jillian Hutchings, who took the minutes of that all those meetings, said that he was one of the most open people, and he never felt that he looked down on her. You know, she came from a administrative secretarial background, and she felt she could ask him anything, and he wouldn't take it amiss whether she knew something or not.
Did you guys keep in contact?
We didn't really. I think when he became a minister, let me first say on a personal note, if you're involved in facilitating or helping processes, when the parties meet each other and they reach each other, then the facades, you know, the sort of work that helped the negotiations go, they fall away. So I understood that. We met once or twice at conferences, and it was a cordial relationship, but we didn't really kept in personal touch.
Well, with his role at SARS and as finance minister, that's undisputed. And he was also relentlessly pursued by the former public protector, Busisiwe Mgubane, over allegations of a so-called rogue unit at SARS. Well, at the same time, you know, as the Minister of Public Enterprises, he faced some criticism for his state-centric approach to the state-owned enterprises. And he was also accused then of being unapproachable. What are your thoughts on sort of what seems to be a bit of a duality about his legacy?
Look, I think I wasn't close to that, and I know as much as anyone who read the media or watched the media knew. My sense was that there was a blind spot there. And that he became, as we all do when we get older, became more like he was, and that his ideological views about the role of the state, and obviously the role of the ANC, took over, and obviously he had to play a different role there than he had to play at the negotiations. At the negotiations, he was expected to play a facilitating, accommodating, compromise-seeking role. Yeah, he had to, under difficult circumstances, he had to run those enterprises, and he stuck to his guns by saying that the state must own SAA and the state must play a role. I think that's the one blind spot that he became more statist than he even might have been earlier. The second one is where I did meet him fairly recently was at a conference before the election. Where a group of NGOs, many of them ANC aligned, got together and basically said that they're not happy with what the ANC is doing, and they criticized the ANC heavily. And he was there. I know Ruth Meyer was there, although not anymore in the ANC capacity, obviously, and one or two others. And I heard from Ruth afterwards that he was very perturbed by the negativity about the ANC. So I think what happened to many other ANC leaders, including our president, also happened to him, that it became insulated from the people on the ground. And there was a shock to him that people who used to be ANC supporters could in public, because it was a public meeting, could in public be so critical of the ANC. So in that sense, he may have, perhaps he worked too hard, wasn't well briefed. He may have surrounded him by people who thought like him. I think he lost touch with people on the ground, and that may be another reason why he was criticized for the part he played in that time.
But he was always close to Cyril Ramaphosa, the president. You know, we talked about that time, how important it was, and they Ramaphosa remained a staunch supporter of Pravin.
Yes, yes. I think especially because of his opposition to Zuma, and that he came out in a principled way. I don't know whether Cyril agreed with him all the way. I can't think that Cyril would. But the problem, obviously, what people often don't understand, whether it's Pravin Gordhan or anyone else, if you're a president and you've appointed someone, you understand that you've appointed him or her for certain reasons that 60% of what they do or think you may agree with, but there's always a 40 or a 30% that you don't. And you must accommodate that and decide all the while, can I let him remain a minister even though I don't agree with him? And I'm sure there were many informal discussions about SAA, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they were still close. And what Cyril also said in his remarks after his death shows that. But I don't think they necessarily agreed on those, call it the statist ideas around public enterprise.
So his legacy, would it be for you what he did during that negotiation process?
And what he did at SARS and as finance minister. I think that overshadows any criticism, rightful criticism that one might have when he was at public enterprises. I think what I find very sad and reprehensible almost is the comments that were made on social media about him. I'm not just talking about the EFF, but there were quite a number of South Africans who were actually in the social media commentary brought the fact that he was an Indian South African to the fore. And that was totally, if you had asked me whether Pravin ever referred to him as an Indian, I would say never. It just wasn't part of his being. He was a South African. He was an ANC member. I mean, I would refer more to myself as an Afrikaner and a South African than he did as an Indian. So I think that's unfair and it's a bit sad, but it says more of those people than it says about him. So I think, if I had to say, I think that his legacy is largely positive, by large, positive.
Tien Sialo, thanks so much for speaking to us.